Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
We're launching a free new Aquinas 101 digital platform. Dive into the world of St. Thomas Aquinas with a customized learning environment, certificates of achievement, interactive elements, and a redesigned digital Summa Theologiae featuring a side-by-side Latin to English translation. To be notified when the platform goes live, sign up at go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. That's go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
For St. Thomas Aquinas, the doctrine of divine simplicity is fundamental both to his theological and philosophical considerations of God. Indeed, in the Summa Theologiae, God's simplicity is the very first divine attribute that he addresses after having offered his famous five ways of demonstrating that God exists. Perhaps as foundational to his theological and philosophical thought is the doctrine of participation. But unlike his teaching on divine simplicity, Aquinas' notion of participation at no point receives from him a dedicated quaestio or article. Instead, it's woven throughout his writings and clarified in the course of considerations of such diverse topics as the relation of essence to esse, the phenomenon of natural motion, intellectual cognition, man's awareness of the natural law, and the interrelations of logical intentions such as species and genus. The ultimate principle of participation for Aquinas is God himself, the source of all participations. But how, we might wonder, can God be participated by creatures if, as Aquinas tells us, to participate is partem capere, in a way to grasp, seize, take a part of something? If to participate is to have a share in what is participated, how can God be shared in without his transcendence being compromised? Or to put this another way, how could God be participated in without entering into composition with his effects? It could well seem that the doctrine of divine simplicity precludes any sort of participation of the divine. Aquinas himself seems to say as much when commenting on the writings of Pseudo-Dionysius, telling us explicitly that God's essence, and hence his existence, remains imparticipata, unparticipated, and imparticipabilis, unparticipable. With that said, Aquinas frequently uses the language of participation to speak of the causal relation between God as the first simple and infinite being, and his effects that have a finite, complex share in being. To understand how Aquinas reconciles the doctrine of participation with that of divine simplicity, we first need to understand what participation does and does not entail for Aquinas. So to that end, my paper will have three parts outlined at the top of your handout. In the first, I'll consider what Aquinas means by the notion of participation. In the second part, I'll consider the different types of participation identified by Aquinas, addressing which have relevance for the relation of creatures to God. And then finally, in the third part, I'm going to consider how Aquinas can meaningfully hold that the transcendent, unparticipated God can nevertheless be present in all things. So to the first part of the talk. For the student of Aquinas accustomed to his Aristotelianism, the very language of participation in his writings might seem troubling. We're accustomed to him following Aristotle's stock criticism of Plato's theory of separately subsisting forms, which Plato presented as the essences of sensible things and in which sensible things participate. For example, according to the Platonic account, Socrates is human by participating in the separate form of man, which is the very essence of humanity. Aristotle held, by contrast, that the essences of sensible things are in the things themselves. Since the what it is to be human, or nature of man, entails matter in its logos or ratio, humanity cannot be separate from individual men like Socrates, but instead must be within them, intrinsic to them as human beings. On this point, Aquinas is in complete agreement with Aristotle and follows the critiques of Plato laid out in the Metaphysics. Considering Plato's doctrine of participation there, Aristotle observes of the Platonic forms that, quote, to say that they are exemplars and that other things participate in them is to use empty words and poetic metaphors. Harsh words for his old teacher Plato. Regarding those strong words about participation, however, Aquinas turns out to be less in agreement. Yes, he concurs that as Plato employs participation theory, as it pertains to subsistent forms, Plato speaks in the manner of poets who employ metaphor, which is an inappropriate approach for one engaged in the sciences. Aquinas tells us that the scientist ought to teach instead from proper causes. And yet, he by no means thinks that participation theory is itself unscientific, but again, only as it was employed by Plato. In fact, Aquinas considers participation theory to be in harmony with his Aristotelianism. And as he employs it, participation theory provides new insights regarding key Aristotelian notions. For Aquinas, participation theory becomes far more than poetic metaphor, instead providing a systematic method of analysis that ultimately enables Aquinas even to go beyond what are the limitations of Aristotelianism in the context of Aquinas' distinctive metaphysics of essay. To see how this is the case, we should start, as Aquinas does with so much of his metaphysical investigations, by looking at how we talk about reality. In this respect, he again follows Aristotle, who first presented us with the semantic triangle. Our words, we are told, are signs or symbols of our concepts, which in turn are the likenesses of things. With that in mind, both Aristotle and Aquinas hold that, to a degree, semantic analysis can reveal certain fundamental metaphysical features of reality. Aquinas sees this logical method in metaphysics as justified because being is fundamentally intelligible. As such, it acts upon our minds, reflecting features of reality. And as rational beings, we can understand reality and in turn speak about it. Thus, you can truthfully say of me such things as that I am human, an animal, pale, 5'10" tall, and the father of 3 kids. Some of these names are said of me based on what I am, given my nature, for example, human and animal. Others are said of me not based on what I am, but based upon some trait that I have. Pale from my paleness, 5'10" tall from my height, father from my relation to my children. The first sort of predication Aquinas calls predication per essentiam, predication by essence. The latter he terms predication per participationem, predication by participation. Notice the Platonic language to express a basic linguistic distinction acknowledged by Aristotle between predication based on traits or features of things that are essential and those that are not, that are accidental. But there is this added note, as the language of predication by participation highlights a naming based on having. Most fundamentally of all, Aquinas notes that a thing such as you or me is called a being and ends because it is a haver of esse, habens esse. As he explains, quote, only God is called a being essentially because the divine esse is a subsisting and absolute esse. But the term a being is predicated by participation of any creature, for no creature is its own esse, but instead is a haver of esse. And Aquinas concludes that, quote, whenever something is predicated of another by participation, it must be the case that the thing is other than that which is participated, end quote. In short, what Aquinas points to is that the extra mental foundation for this sort of predication is that there is a distinction in the thing between the haver, the participant, and what it has, the participated. In short, this linguistic analysis reveals that, for Aquinas, participation is a kind of having. Have I hammered that point home enough? Still, he sees it as a distinctive kind of having. Not every kind of having merits the name participation, and not everything that is had is participated in. You might have money in your wallet, but we don't say that you participate in your money, nor do we say that you participate in the clothes that you have on, even though you have those too. So what's distinctive about the sort of having entailed in participation? To answer that question, we first need to consider the more general question of what it means to have. And on this point, Aquinas follows Aristotle, who in the Metaphysics tells us that, quote, having, hexis, Latin habitus, means in one sense a certain action of the haver and of what is had, as a sort of act or motion, end quote. Commenting on this text, Aquinas clarifies that although having is not itself an action, nevertheless, the name having, or to have, Aquinas runs with the infinitive habere, which could also be rendered as a gerund, having. Having nevertheless signifies according to the mode or manner of an action. So it's like an action because it is intermediate between the haver and what is had, in a way that an action, such as heating, is something in between what heats and what is heated, or again, the way that the act of building is in between a builder and what he builds. I think we can extrapolate from Aquinas' observation that if participation is a kind of having, it too is like an action whereby the participant actively participates or shares what it has, even if that quasi-action entails only a conceptual distinction from the haver. Following Aristotle, Aquinas identifies four modes or kinds of having that I have outlined for you on the handout. Again, the Latin is habere. You can see this in figure one on page one. I'm not going to get into the weeds of considering all of his distinctions, but I'll just briefly list the four sorts. The first mode of having entails the use of something either by nature or by will. So someone is said to have clothes or to own any possession. This is just two examples. The second, according to the second mode, a subject is said to have a form that is in it. We're told whether a quantity or an accident or any form whatsoever. According to the third mode of having, a container has what it contains, also a place has what it contains, and a whole, W-H-O-L-E, has or includes its parts. Finally, according to the fourth mode, one thing is said to have another when it prevents that thing from acting according to its natural impulse. We're told that the roof of a building would, by its own impulse, fall if it weren't for the pillars that hold it up. In that sense, the pillars have the roof. Perhaps that sense is a bit strained in English, but less so, I think, if we consider maybe a parent holding a nervous child, and the parent might reassure that child by saying, "Don't worry, I have you. I've got you. You won't fall." Of the four sorts of having, what Aristotle and Aquinas list as the second sort seems at first blush most relevant for the kind of having involved with participation. That, again, is the mode according to which a subject is said to have a form that is in it. As Aquinas puts it, according to this mode, quote, this is going to be a mouthful, I'll repeat it, that in which something exists as in the proper susceptible is said to have that form. Again, that, the subject, in which something exists, what's had, as in the proper susceptible, is said to have that form. In proprio susceptibili. That's a rather perhaps obscure phrase in English, in the proper susceptible, but it's less obscure if we consider what Aquinas would view as a synonym for susceptible, namely the term receptive. In this case, what is capable of receiving some form. So when a receptive subject, in fact, has received some form, it has that form. And as Aquinas notes elsewhere, the terminus or endpoint of receiving is having. And it turns out receptivity of form is a key feature of the sort of having that's involved in his account of participation. So a participant has a share in what it participates, what it has a share in, it has received. Now, the concern for my talk is to help us get a sense of how, for Aquinas, created beings can be said to participate in God in this sense of receiving and having God in some way. Again, the problem is, how is that possible if God is absolutely simple? The very language of reception and possession implies composition between haver and had, because what is had is in the haver. In fact, following Aristotle, Aquinas concludes his treatment of the four senses of having in this commentary on the Metaphysics by noting that, quote, being in something, the Latin is esse in, is said in a similar way as having, habere, is said. And the modes of being in something follow the modes of having. And Aquinas reminds us that in the Physics, Aristotle identifies eight modes of being in. And here, one of these nice instances in a commentary, Aquinas goes beyond the text at hand in the commentary on the Metaphysics to walk through each of those eight cases. Aristotle just makes the general observation, the modes of being in correspond to the modes of having. Aquinas walks through all eight, and I present in the right-hand column of figure one how those eight. So if you see them all out of order, that's because, well, that's how they correspond to the four modes of having. So instead of walking you through all of these modes of being in, I'll simply note that the fifth mode of being in, identified by Aristotle, is the way that a form is said to be in a subject. That corresponds to the second mode of having that we've just been looking at. So notice how our language of participation highlights this feature of inness when we speak of the relationship between participant and what is participated. Now, in English, we say that X participates in Y. The air participates in the light of the sun, or the kettle participates in the heat of the stove. But this prepositional phrasing in English, in fact, inverts the structure of participation as Aquinas understands it, because it isn't the haver that enters into the had, but the other way around. So when Aquinas employs the Latin term participare, we don't find him using the construction participat in or participant in. For Aquinas, the verb to participate is a transitive verb that takes a direct object. In other words, the participant participates what is in it. So for Aquinas, air doesn't participate in light, rather, it participates light when light is in the air. Similarly, a kettle isn't said to participate in heat for Aquinas, but rather to participate heat when heat is in it. Again, this is so because the participant participates what is in it. Now, this phrasing, no doubt, will sound odd to the English speaker's ear. Perhaps even more surprising is Aquinas' use of the Latin term participatio, whose cognate is the familiar English term participation. Now, we use that word participation in a way that's different than the way Aquinas uses it, as we commonly use this term it is with an active sense of signifying that kind of having. So it signifies according to the mode of an action as something that the participant does. But curiously, as Aquinas commonly uses the Latin term participatio, it is according to a passive sense to signify not the activity of having, but the item that is had. For Aquinas, a participation is some form that is in the participant. And the reader who's unaware of this fact is left, therefore, scratching his head when Aquinas tells us that, quote, and I apologize, these aren't on the handouts, but participations are made determinate in participants from the capacity and nature of the participants. And again, when he tells us, among participants, to the degree that something is more composite, to that degree it's more noble. Now, that might sound surprising because we think of the simple as the more noble, but among things that are composites, to the degree that they're more composite, he says, but I do not mean by material composition, but by the reception of more participations, meaning more participated forms, more participated perfections. And so we find Aquinas noting of accidents in general that, quote, although an accident is not a participant, it is nevertheless a participation. And finally, as regards created essay, Aquinas tells us that, quote, the essay of each thing is a certain participation of the divine essay. And I'm going to argue that think of here really should be read as from the divine essay. And he notes elsewhere that among all other participations, essay is prior. As a sidebar, I would say that I think this reading of the term participatio in the passive sense makes much more sense of the semantic distinction between predication per essentiam and predication per participationem. As I was noting a moment ago, the former sort of predication names a being from what it is. The latter, predication per participationem, names the being from what it has. In other words, it'd probably be better to translate as predication by a participation. Predication from what the being has, what's in the participant. Now, with all that said, surely it's fine for us to adjust the language in translation and use the term participation according to an active sense, as we customarily do, and speak also of participants as participating in various formal perfections, as we commonly do, but only as long as we don't lose the sense of what Aquinas himself is saying or what his concerns are, what's driving his investigations. However we phrase the situation in English, we want to be aware that Aquinas' concern is to insist that whatever the participatory relationship is of creature to God, God does not enter into composition with his effects. Indeed, since God is pure act, he can't enter into composition with anything at all. So this leaves the question then, how is he received by his effects in such a way that he can, in some sense, be said to be participated? To answer that question, we still need some more clarification regarding what Aquinas' understanding is of what it means to participate. So far, what I've been laying out, what we've seen, is that participation, meaning the act of participating, is a kind of having. More precisely, it's the sort of having that entails a subject receiving some sort of form or formal perfection. So not every sort of having is an instance of participation. Similarly, Aquinas indicates that not every sort of reception results in participation. In his commentary on Boethius' De Hebdomadibus, Aquinas offers his most thorough treatment of what participation entails. There he offers an account that most scholars of Aquinas on this topic take to be his authoritative definition of what it means to participate. After having given that etymology of the Latin term participare, partem capere, to seize or grasp a part, Aquinas tells us the following, and you can see the breakdown of this text in figure 2 on page 2 with that wildly complicated infographic, but we can walk through the various parts of it later. But at the very top, I give that quotation where he gives this definition, definitional account. Aquinas tells us that, quote, when something receives in a particular way what belongs to another in a universal way, it is said to participate that, or we might say in English, in that. In short, participation, the act of participating, entails the sort of receiving and having that results in a limitation. Or in other words, some formal perfection is received and possessed by the participant and enters into composition with it. And what results from that composition is a limitation of the formal perfection as it is found in the participant. So what is universal or unlimited in another is found in a particularized way in the participant. Lying behind Aquinas's account is the Neoplatonic notion that formal perfections in themselves are infinite and that limitation comes with composition. It's a notion that he gets from such sources as Proclus, Pseudo-Dionysius, and the anonymous author of the Book of Causes. And yet, it's a notion that Aquinas synthesizes with fundamental Aristotelian philosophical notions. And this is evidenced in the examples that he gives of three modes or kinds of participation in accord with his definition from his commentary on the De Hebdomadibus. So what I'm going to do next is briefly walk through these examples and modes so that we can identify the relevant ways in which Aquinas thinks that created being can be said in some sense to participate God. And so you can see those in the top frames of figure 2. And then we'll walk through the second. So to the second part of my talk, Aquinas tells us that what he identifies as the first mode of participation or participating, he simply illustrates by way of examples, noting that man participates animal, and Socrates participates man. The examples might well surprise the reader at first, given Aquinas' Aristotelianism and his view that Socrates is called man and animal per essentiam, which is to say by his substance or essence, and not by participation. As I noted at the outset, terms such as human and animal name what a being such as Socrates is rather than what he has. So we might wonder whether Aquinas suddenly adopted a Platonic account of participation in separate forms. But as we read on in the text, it becomes clear that Aquinas isn't speaking of a Platonic structure of participation here. Instead, he has in mind what we might call a conceptual participation concerning the relation of less universal concepts to more universal ones, the concept of an individual in relation to a species, or of a species in relation to a genus. Keeping in mind his definition of what it means to participate, he explains that there is participation here because in each example, some ratio, some intelligible content, is possessed by the participant, but not according to the full universality of that ratio. So the species man thus has what the genus animal is, but in a limited way, and so too mutatis mutandis regarding the notion of an individual such as Socrates with reference to the species concept man. So for this reason, Aquinas's first mode of participation has traditionally been interpreted by scholars as a logical or conceptual participation rather than a real one. If we think back to the modes of having noted before, and you can see it in figure 1 on page 1, this first mode of participation, I think, would be an instance of the third mode of having, whereby a whole has its parts, to be precise, the way a species as a universal whole, for example, contains a genus in its definition. Now, in terms of our own question regarding creatures participating God, we can see quickly that this mode has no immediate or direct bearing on our investigation, Both God and creature are real beings, not concepts, nor does God enter into the definition of a created being, such as man or an animal. By contrast, the second mode of participation identified by Aquinas does concern a type of real participation. Here again, he merely gives us examples to illustrate what he has in mind, noting that according to this mode, a subject participates in accident and matter participates form. Here again, an Aristotelian-minded reader might be surprised by the examples. Accidents exist in their subjects, and so too form exists in matter. Why are we using the language of participation? There are no separately subsisting Platonic forms at play here. But he quickly explains to us why, noting that, quote, a substantial form or an accidental form, which is universal according to its ratio, is determined to this or that subject. So here, what he's doing is presenting familiar Aristotelian compositions from the Neoplatonic perspective of reception and limitation. In this way, participation theory explains a feature of the inner structure of finite beings that results from that composition. So, for example, in the course of commenting on Aristotle's physics, Aquinas observes that, quote, everything that participates is composed of the participant and the participated, and the participant is in potency to the participated. So we get Aristotelian language worked in there. And elsewhere, he notes that everything that participates something is compared to what is participated as potency to act. So with the second mode of participation, we find an instance of the second sort of having noted in figure one, which concerns the having of any form whatsoever. Elsewhere, Aquinas will extend this account of having and what we may term participation by composition to the most fundamental intrinsic compositional structure in his system, namely of essence and esse in created beings, noting that, quote, everything participates its own created esse. So no, it's not a separate esse, the esse that it has, it participates that. Everything participates its own created esse by which it formally exists. I think these last words are noteworthy for what it implies, again, is that God is not the formal esse of all things. Created beings do not participate in God's esse, or God's esse is not in created things. Again, they participate their own esse that is intrinsic to them. So when Aquinas considers Dionysius's statement that, quote, the esse of all things is the superessential divinity, Aquinas is careful to caution us against what he describes as the perverted understanding or distorted understanding, intellectus perversus, that some people have offered of this authoritative text. As he explains, to read Dionysius as indicating that God's esse is the intrinsic formal esse by which all things exist isn't even consonant with the words of Dionysius, who elsewhere observes that in God himself, quote, in God himself, there is neither contact nor any commingling with other things in the manner of a point with a line or the shape of a seal with wax. With that said, Aquinas' position that everything formally exists by its own esse should not be read as indicating his view that created beings are existentially self-sufficient. Although such beings have sufficiency in the order of formal causality, they nevertheless are ever dependent upon God in the order of efficient causality to both give them esse and conserve them in existence. And this fact is acknowledged with the third mode of participation identified by Aquinas in his De Hebdomadibus commentary. Here again, he just gives us a description. He describes this as the way an effect participates in its cause, and especially, he adds, when the effect is not equal to the power of its cause. And to illustrate what he has in mind, Aquinas gives us an example: air participating in the light of the sun because it does not receive that light with the same brilliance that it has, that light has in the sun. As with the second or compositional mode of participation, this third mode is real rather than merely conceptual, which is clear if we consider Aquinas' view that a cause is something from which the existence of another follows. With this mode of participation, Aquinas brings out the real dependence that effects have upon their cause for their received perfection, as is evidenced from his example of air as dependent upon the light of the sun for its illumination. And that's one of his favorite examples to employ in such considerations of the giving of essay. Elsewhere, he works out the structure of this sort of real participation in greater detail for us. You can take a look on page 3 at text 1. He notes, for example, quote, "Everything that participates something," which is to say every participant, "receives that which it participates," in other words, what it has, the participated formal perfection, "from that from which it participates. And in this respect, that from which it participates is its cause," in other words, its efficient cause. And Aquinas tells us, for example, air has a participated light from the sun, which is the cause of its illumination. So, for example, when Aquinas considers God's conservation of his effects in existence, he observes that every creature is related to God as air is to the sun illuminating it. He tells us that the sun shines by its own nature, whereas air is made luminous only by participating in light from the sun. Nevertheless, he emphasizes, not by participating in the nature of the sun. So the air is getting its own light. It's really getting its own light, but it's dependent to have that light for every moment that's illuminated on the sun. And in a similar way, Aquinas tells us, God is being by his own nature, ens per essentiam suam, because he is his very esse, whereas every creature is a being participatively, ens participative, precisely because its essence is not its own esse. Aquinas' example of the air's illumination reveals a number of elements regarding this third mode of participation. Number one, it illustrates something about the participant, that the participant is dependent in the order of efficient causality upon some principle. In the order of, efficient causality, the sun to receive what it participates, light. Number two, the example illustrates something about that very participated perfection, namely that it is present in the participant, the air, and that it depends upon its efficient causal principle, as I said before, to sustain it there. Third, this example illustrates something about that principle, that source itself, namely that it has the participated perfection by its very nature, light in the sun. And moreover, that the nature of the principle remains unparticipated by the participant. Fourth and finally, the light is present in the air as a likeness, a similitudo of the sun's brightness. So this example of the illumination of air by the sun thus provides us with a clearer sense of what Aquinas sees entailed with the third mode of participation. The effect, by means of an inherent form, participates in a likeness of its cause. That form is that by which it's like its cause. It participates in a likeness of its cause and not in the nature of that cause. As Aquinas notes in another context, quote, "An effect participates an efficient cause only according to the assimilation of form." Again, the nature of the cause remains in itself unparticipated. And it is with participation in the light of the sun, so it is mutatis mutandis with participation in esse. The created being, as participant, is dependent in the order of efficient causality upon God as its principle, namely for its esse to be both received and sustained as an inherent formal likeness. In the order of formal causality, this esse is present in the participant and is the likeness of God, who is its efficient and exemplar cause. So we see that at times Aquinas is emphatic. Finite beings do not participate God, but rather participate, as he puts it, God's likeness. Or to put it in the language of being in, esse in, God's creative act does not entail God himself in his nature being in the creature, but rather what is in the creature is created esse, according to which the creature is like God. So created beings have, in a particular way, by participation, or the language I was using earlier, by a participation, a participated perfection that's in it, what their cause, God, is universally in his essence. And again, an essence that in itself remains unparticipated. So among the many arguments that Aquinas offers in question 3 of the Prima Pars to affirm God's simplicity, we find one presented in terms of the unparticipated character of the divine essence. Having denied in the first 7 articles of the Quaestio, one by one, every sort of composition in God, Aquinas concludes in Article 8 by considering whether God enters into composition with other things, his effects. The third and final argument that he gives, this is text number 2 on the handout, the third and final argument that he gives is that no part of a composite can be absolutely primary among beings. This is clear as regards matter, which is in potency, but the same is the case as regards the form of a composite, because such a form is a participated form. But we're told whatever participates, and also whatever is participated, is posterior to what is such through its essence. And to illustrate by way of example, he notes that fire in an ignited object is posterior to what is fire and fiery by its very essence, namely fire itself. And Aquinas concludes by reminding us that he has by this point in the Summa already shown that God is the absolutely primary being, the primum ens simpliciter. The reader is then left to draw the unstated conclusion. Therefore, God is a form that does not enter into composition with his effects and is unparticipated. And thus concludes question 3 on divine simplicity. And yet, just a few questions later, we might suddenly be surprised to find Aquinas arguing in Quaestio 8 that God is nevertheless in all things, affirming with what is reported by some to be St. Gregory the Great's gloss on the Song of Songs that, quote, God is in a universal way in all things by his presence, power, and substance, end quote. I should note that Gregory also acknowledges a familiar or particular way in which God is in things as regards grace. And Aquinas notes this particular way as well as the particular way that the divine esse is in Christ. I'll leave these points to the theologians to hash out. If we consider simply this famous Gregorian triad, we find Aquinas clarifying that the term substantia should be read as signifying essentia. So he acknowledges that in some sense, God is in things by his very essence, per essentiam. How, we might wonder, can he be in them in this way without his essence being a participation that is had by them? In other words, how can he be in them per essentiam without entering into composition with them? So with these questions in mind, I'll turn now to the third part of my talk to consider the way in which Aquinas holds that an unparticipated God can be in all things. As I've noted, question 8 of the Prima Pars considers whether it belongs to God to be in all things. And in the first article, Aquinas seeks to answer the general question. And at the start of his responsio, he immediately observes that God is indeed in all things. Then he adds the qualifiers, not as part of their essence, nor as an accident, but as an agent that acts upon them. An agent, he tells us, is any agent is conjoined with whatever it immediately acts upon. And in this way, the power of the agent touches or is connected to its effect. In support of this position, Aquinas references what Aristotle proves in Physics 7, namely that a mover and what is moved must be together, simul. Focusing then on God's agency, Aquinas next tells us that because God is esse by his very essence, his proper effect must be created esse. Just as igniting things is the proper effect of fire. Shifting his comparative example of efficient causality, Aquinas returns to the now familiar case study of air that is illuminated by the light of the sun, implicitly drawing a contrast with the example of items heated by fire. As he notes elsewhere, some objects that are heated by fire, such as water, can retain the heat that they receive. By contrast, air cannot retain the light that it receives from the sun, but instead is dependent upon the sun to remain illuminated. And he notes this point about illuminated air here too in Article 1 of Question 8. Having clarified this model of causality, Aquinas explains that in a similar way, God is the cause of esse in existing things, not only at the first moment that they begin to exist, but for as long as they are preserved in existence. Thus, as long as a thing has esse, God must be present to it, ad sit ei. Present to it according to the mode by which that thing has esse. In other words, God must be in all existing things as their efficient cause as long as they exist. Moreover, Aquinas adds, esse is innermost for each thing, magis intimum, most intimate, and most deeply within all things, since it is formal with respect to everything else that is in a thing. So he concludes that not only that God is in all things, but that he is in them innermostly, intimately. After he next considers in Article 2 whether God is everywhere, Aquinas proceeds in Article 3 of Question 8 to address that observation attributed to St. Gregory, that God is in all things according to essence, presence, and power. Now, in the interest of time, I won't discuss all of the points addressed in this article, but will instead simply note Aquinas' conclusions. He explains that God is in all things by his power, because all things are subject to his power. God is in all things by his presence, because all things are, quote, laid bare and open to his eyes. Finally, we're told God is in all things by essence, because he is in all things as the cause of their esse. And Aquinas clarifies, in reply to the first objection of this article, that to say that God is in all things per essentiam is not to say that he is in things as belonging to their essence, but rather that it is by his essence that he is in them, but again, as the cause of esse. Now, on a number of occasions, Aquinas makes reference to these three ways in which God is in all things, but he offers only two ex professo treatments of the triad other than in the Summa Theologiae, namely in his early Commentary on the Sentences and in his Compendium Theologiae, which is contemporaneous with the Summa. We find some interesting variations in his presentations of these three ways and can discuss them during the Q&A, but the common overarching theme in all of them is the way God is in things as an efficient cause is in its effects. And here we should recall Aquinas' Aristotelian position that the modes of being in something correspond to the modes of having and being had. If that is the case, we might well wonder why God's essence, which is identical with his power and his action, isn't had or participated by the effect in which it is found. Complicating matters is that Aquinas' presentation of this Gregorian triad inverts the being in relationship presented by Aristotle in the Physics. There, Aristotle says, and Aquinas following him, and in the Metaphysics commentary as well, that the moved is presented as in the mover, and more generally, an effect is presented as in its cause. Commenting on the physics, Aquinas observes that this sixth way of being in something follows because the effect is in the power of the cause. And in his commentary on the Metaphysics, he knows that this sense of being in corresponds to the first sort of having. So why in these other contexts that look at how God is in things, does he say that the cause is in the effect? It seems as though the Gregorian distinction has forced Aquinas to rearrange the Aristotelian order of the relation between effect and cause on this point, but not without reason. And Aquinas finds a very clever way of making the two accounts harmonize, as is brought out in response to an objection in question 8, article 1. This is text 3 on your handouts. There, an objector raises the question that if God were in anything, wouldn't he be contained by it? So the objector seems to have in mind the third sort of having identified by Aristotle. The objector points out, God isn't contained by anything, rather he contains them. So the conclusion of the objection, God can't be in things, but instead they are in him. And in reply, Aquinas grants that with corporeal things that are said to be in something, they are in that thing as contained. But we find something different with spiritual things. They, by contrast, contain the things that they are in. So when a spiritual thing is in something, it contains what it is in. For example, Aquinas notes, the soul, which is in the body, contains the body. So also, God is in things, we're told, but as containing them. So I find this reply to be of particular interest for our concerns regarding the topic of participation and divine simplicity, because it shows Aquinas going beyond the Aristotelian, or I take to be going beyond the Aristotelian analysis of being in and having. Here Aquinas is showing us there is a way in which the item that can be said to be in another isn't had by that other. And so it's not participated by that other. And I think it's noteworthy that nowhere in question 8 of the Prima Pars, discussing how God is in things, does Aquinas make any mention of participation or use any variant of the term. It's like he studiously avoids the language of participation. The same is the case in the Sentences commentary, where he treats this Gregorian triad regarding God's essence, presence, and power. It's only in the Compendium Theologiae treatment that we find the language of participation. This is text 4 on your handout. That's on the last page. So it's only in the Compendium Theologiae that we find participation language when Aquinas tells us that God is in all things, quote, by essence, inasmuch as the esse of each thing is a certain participation, participatio, of the divine essence. And thus the divine essence is in each existing thing, inasmuch as it, the existing thing, has esse, namely, God is in them as a cause to its proper effect. So by now, of course, we all know that the Latin term participatio signifies not the activity of having, of participating, but rather what is received by the participant as something possessed and had. And in this case, that is the being's own esse. It is a participation of the divine essence in the sense of having a formal perfection from the divine essence. It's not an activity by which the creature enters into the divine essence or by which that essence enters into the creature. In this way, God is in all things while remaining unparticipated in himself. Some concluding thoughts. We've seen that for Aquinas, for one thing to participate another entails the participant receiving and having what it participates. Since whatever is had is in the haver, what is participated is received into the participant, resulting in composition and limitation. It's for this reason, again, that Aquinas defines what it is to participate as, quote, receiving in a particular way what belongs to another in a universal way. So with the foregoing in mind, we can see why he would consider God, who is absolutely simple and infinite, to be unparticipated. His nature as such cannot be received. It cannot enter into composition with another. It cannot be limited. It's instead, what can be and is received and limited is a created act of existing, an act that is innermost in a created being and is caused most intimately by God. Thus, what God is in an unlimited way, a created being receives and has in a limited way. It is by participating in its own inner act of existing, then, that the created being participates in a likeness of the absolutely simple being who is the source of all participations, but remains in himself entirely unparticipated. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.